you all heard, I did put out a declaration of health emergency in response to respiratory illnesses, which have been causing a significant portion of pediatric patients to be hospitalized.
Orange County Health Officer Dr. Regina Chinsisho Kwong on Monday, she declared a state of emergency in Orange County over a serious rise in cases of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. The virus disproportionately affects kids, and it comes on top of an early start to the flu season and, of course, the lingering pandemic. Officials at Children's Health of Orange County say they're seeing record numbers of kids now. And here to talk about this is Dr. Catherine Williamson. She's a pediatrician there. Welcome back to Press Play, Doctor.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, describe what it looks like at your facility.
It is very busy. So as a shock pediatrician, I work both in outpatient, but I am very well connected to what's going on in the hospital. And we have a number of sick kids with many different respiratory viruses, the leading of which is RSV, and flu is closely behind.
And so do you have enough capacity? Are you at capacity? What does it look like in terms of beds?
Yeah, so countywide, 95% of our pediatric hospital beds are filled, with many patients in the ED waiting to get into the available beds. So we are very full there. And specifically at CHOC, the emergency department has expanded their capacity to meet the numbers. And we are still hitting record numbers more than we've ever seen historically. And that record keeps breaking a few times a week.
Oh, my goodness. So how old are the kids, and what kind of symptoms are they exhibiting?
Yeah, so RSV traditionally affects little ones, so infants and children under two, also over two, but more significantly for the little kids. But we are seeing kids who are older affected by RSV. And I think it's also good to remember that the elderly can be affected as well. So the ages are ranging all over, but particularly the younger kids. And it's a respiratory virus. So that means cough, congestion, some difficulty breathing. I sent a patient this morning to the hospital who was actually breathing okay, but he wasn't drinking, and he is getting severely dehydrated and needs some fluids.
Is this deadly, this disease?
It can be. Fortunately, RSV doesn't usually cause too many pediatric deaths, which is fantastic, but it can cause significant illness. So the RSV virus can last for a very long time. It lasts for longer than the common cold. And generally, what we call supportive care is needed, which is essentially oxygen. And if we need to help suction out nasal discharge, like, you know, snot, and help clear their lungs. But it's a virus, and there is no treatment for a virus. We essentially have to wait for it to pass and make sure the kids are breathing well and staying hydrated as it does.
Mm. And it affects the little ones because they have little airways, right? Tiny air passages that get clogged.
Exactly. So what's happening is there is just a whole lot of congestion. And so the chests get really congested. And because all the air passages are very, very tiny, it's easy for them to get plugged up and much more easy for them to have a difficult time breathing.
So adults can get it, right? But it's not as serious?
Exactly. So for adults, it tends to be just a really bummer of a cold. It can last a couple of weeks, lots of chest congestion. You don't sleep as well at night, but you don't usually have difficulty breathing.
All right, but they can pass it on to the kids, and then that can be a serious problem. What should parents be on the lookout for, and when should they take a kid to the emergency room?
Yeah, so there are so many other cough and cold viruses going around right now, and sometimes RSV can present like any other cough and cold virus, and if that's all your child is having, they're probably not going to need to be seen in the ED. So things to look for are a cough that is causing any difficulty breathing. So what I usually say is look at their belly and watch their chest. So if you look under, look at your child's belly, look under the shirt, look to see if they're really, really using those muscles to breathe. And if they're having a difficult time, that is a red flag to go directly to either your doctor that day, the urgent care, or the emergency department. And then the other thing, which is less common, but again, I saw that in my patient today, is that they're just not drinking. Sometimes these kids are feeling so crummy, they don't want to drink, they don't want to eat, and they can get severely dehydrated.
Okay, so when they go into the emergency department, they might get an intravenous fluid set up, or they might get their lungs suctioned, that kind of thing?
So it's not so much suctioning the lungs, it's giving them oxygen and then helping to suction their nasal passages.
I
Because
see.
for little ones, for babies, they breathe a lot through their nose. So if they're really, really stuffy in their nose, will help to suction out all the snot that's in their nose and then put them on oxygen as well.
Why is this such a problem now, if it's been around for many years?
So RSV it's a common winter virus, but this season, I mean, we're barely into winter. We already started seeing influenza and RSV cases in mid-August. That is incredibly early. And we're seeing it spike right now more than we have in other seasons. And this doesn't happen infrequently. We do see RSV surges, you know, periodically, you know, every few years or so. But right now we have the combination of it. If it happening earlier in the season, we have so many other colds going around. I had briefly mentioned influenza. I'm seeing a lot of kids with influenza who are getting very sick in our offices, and some are needing to go to the ER. So it's a lot of different viruses happening at once. And we're getting a super high number of kids who are getting RSV.
And is there something to the idea that because kids were indoors for a couple of years during the pandemic, that they didn't have any exposure to RSV? And so they're all getting it all at once now that they're more exposed, going to school and daycare and things like that?
Yeah, that is one theory, that since we haven't seen very high numbers in the last couple of years, that kids who are maybe 2 and 3 year old, two years and 3 years old now, who may have had RSV when they were younger, haven't had it. So now we're seeing newborns all the way up to kids who were indoors through the pandemic earlier on. And so everybody's getting sick all at once.
And do flu vaccines or COVID vaccines prevent at all the seriousness of RSV or anything along those lines?
So they don't specifically prevent RSV, but they do prevent having a few different viruses at a time. So, you know, studies have shown that kids oftentimes when they have a cold or they have a virus that their body's trying to fight, oftentimes it's not just one virus, it is multiple viruses at a time. So if you can imagine a kid who has RSV and also has influenza, and you know, may also even have another common cold virus, that kid's more than likely going to be really, really sick. So we don't have a vaccine for RSV, unfortunately, but we do have a vaccine for influenza, and we do have a vaccine for COVID. So one of the best things that parents can do for themselves, their kids, and the rest of their families is get your kids vaccinated, get yourselves vaccinated, because you can prevent some of this.
I understand there are some trials undergoing now, late stage trials, for an RSV vaccine. Should that be approved, would you recommend that parents give that to their infants?
Yes, absolutely. An RSV vaccine would be fantastic. The more we can keep our kids healthy and safe, with such a safe and effective way like vaccines, the better.
And just in terms of what's happening in your hospital and in children's hospitals across the country, are there enough pediatricians to be on call for this emergency?
It's always a big question. I mean, right now, yes, we are definitely at our capacity, but we have not turned one patient away. We are making sure every child who needs to be seen is seen. So we're making it work. I think what I can ask of the community and all my patients, parents, and myself is, you know, if your child is sick, if you are sick, don't send them to school. Don't go to work. Really trying to reduce the spread in the community is the best thing we can do, because we do have a limited number of pediatricians and hospital beds that we're already seeing is, you know, running scarce.
All right. Dr. Catherine Williamson, pediatrician at Children's Health of OC. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Coming up, slavery is on the ballot in 5 states. It's actually allowed in the Constitution in the 13th Amendment for people who are incarcerated. Well, several measures would get rid of that provision. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This sounds crazy, but slavery is on the ballot in next week's midterms. The 13th Amendment barred involuntary servitude and enslavement more than 150 years ago, with one key exception: as a punishment for crime. That is the direct quote from the text. So prisons can force inmates to work and pay nothing or just a few cents an hour. On the ballot in five states now, measures that would ban that practice. California, by the way, is not among those five states. California rejected the idea of paying inmates a living wage a few years ago because officials feared, well, that would cost the state billions of dollars. Sharon Dolovich is a professor at UCLA, where she leads their prison law and policy program. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So give me a scope of how widespread this practice is, using inmates for labor in prisons, and how much their labor is valued at.
It's a standard practice. I don't know of any jurisdiction where incarcerated people aren't required to work. There are many places where there aren't enough jobs for everybody. So in many facilities, only some people are working, but it's not because there's not a requirement that everyone work. It's just that there aren't enough jobs for people. When people work, they get paid at best pennies on the dollar. I guess with one exception, if there are private industries that come in and set up, let's say, call centers or light manufacturing, they might pay a dollar an hour. And those jobs are very sought after because you get more than, you know, let's say, 8 cents an hour. But obviously, it's well below minimum wage.
Right. So sought after. Do they not mind doing this? Does it give them something to do? Do they object?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes this issue complicated is, on the one hand, we are basically making people work, I mean, essentially for free in most cases. On the other hand, people who are incarcerated would prefer to have something to do rather than nothing. And, you know, if you're making, let's say, 20 cents an hour, you can accrue a little bit of money that you will be able to spend in the commissary or maybe even send home to your family. So when I said that those, you know, let's say if there's a private company that's paying a dollar an hour, those jobs are sought after because you could make more money, even if it's not much, by our standards, and then you can send it maybe home to your family.
Yeah. Well, there's also the idea, kind of a broader idea, perhaps, that inmates shouldn't profit from their crimes, right?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting way to put it when we're talking about labor, because if you are working, let's say, in the kitchen or in the laundry of the facility that you're living in, and you were paid a minimum wage, you wouldn't be profiting from your crime. You'd be profiting from the work that you did to help the facility run. And the thing that's going on here is that states are able to run prisons on the cheap because they don't pay a fair wage for the work that is necessary to be done to make the prison run. So, you know, in any facility, you have to have food service, you have to have laundry, you have to have a janitorial staff. And if the state had to pay minimum wage for all that work, prisons would be a lot more expensive. Now, my own view is that should be the way it is, because if that's what prisons cost, that's what prisons cost. And the alternative is to basically force people to work for free, which is a violation of every fair labor principle that operates when we're talking about people who are not in custody.
When did this begin? Was it always thus?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think as long as there have been prisons, incarcerated people have been required to work. If you go back to the plantation prisons of the post-Reconstruction era in the South, incarcerated people were working in the fields on property that had been plantations before the Civil War. And in fact, in Angola Prison and in Cummins Farm in Arkansas and in Parchment Farm in Mississippi, you still have incarcerated people forced to work in the fields. And by forced, what I mean is, if they refuse to work, then they will be subject to disciplinary sanctions. And, you know, they might be denied access to the yard, they might be denied access to commissary. Under certain circumstances, they might lose their good time credit. So people who are working in prisons today are actually doing work very like what people did when they were enslaved.
So there is a direct link then, right?
Yeah, there's a direct link. And it's not a coincidence that in states that have basically plantation labor on their prisons, the incarcerated population is disproportionately African-American. So you'll see scenes even today, if you go to Angola Prison in Louisiana, of a majority of African-Americans working in the fields and white officers overseeing them, if you will, with guns, and it looks a lot like slave days.
Yeah. So it's interesting that Louisiana is one of the five states, and three of them are southern states that have measures on the ballot this November that would ban this practice.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think what we're seeing is the push to change the 13th Amendment analogs in former Confederate states is a function of a move for racial justice. And these proposed changes are, you know, are emerging from that push to rethink racial dynamics in the states, which I think is obviously long overdue.
Do these measures have bipartisan support?
I think we're going to have to wait and see. My guess is that they're going to pass everywhere they're on the ballot, but we'll just have to see.
So would that mean then that they would be paid, the prisoners would be paid minimum wage?
So I think it's important to understand that even if all of these provisions pass, there will be no immediate practical effect on the ground. What will happen is, let's say in Alabama, where they've removed the accept as punishment for crime clause, what you're going to see is incarcerated workers and their advocates pushing in courts and legislatures to say, hey, we've just changed this language in our Constitution, and that actually should have some practical effects for us on the ground. And I actually think there are going to be two different lines of argument or efforts to make change. One of them is the argument that we're already seeing in Colorado, which passed similar provision getting rid of its except as punishment for crime clause in 2018. Right now in Colorado, there's a case in the courts where incarcerated workers are arguing that if I refuse to work and you impose disciplinary sanctions on me, as punishment, that's effectively slavery, and that's banned by the new provision. And that's just an argument that people are making, and then the question is whether the legal process is going to vindicate that argument. So I think one of the arguments that we're going to see is that these changes mean that people should no longer be forced to work on pain of some negative penal, you know, punishment consequence. And the other, I think, is going to be that if people are required to work, the changes to the 13th Amendment analog should require a minimum wage. And it's interesting that in terms of the, at least in terms of the first suggestion argument that we should no longer be forced to work at all, in Tennessee, what they've said, you know, what's on the ballot there is to change the provision to say slavery and indentured servitude shall be forever prohibited, but nothing in this section shall prohibit an inmate from working while the inmate has been duly convicted of a crime. So in Tennessee, the crafting of the provision already anticipated the argument that any requirement of work for incarcerated people is slavery and rejected it.
So why? And I guess I'm a little confused by that. Why is it on the ballot at all then if it would be negated?
It's a great question. I do think there is some daylight between the accept as punishment for crime provision and the nothing shall prohibit an inmate from working while they've been duly convicted of a crime. Because in the first instance, it implies that pretty much any kind of treatment that might have been meted out to an enslaved person or an indentured servant would be justified and constitutional against an incarcerated person. And this is saying you can't have slavery, but we don't in this state, you know, if it's passed, what it would be saying is we in this state don't see a work requirement as slavery if you're incarcerated. But that doesn't mean that we can do anything, that all bets are off. And I actually think of the two arguments that I suggested to you, one, that these changes would mean incarcerated people shouldn't have to work at all, and the other being incarcerated workers should receive basic fair labor standards protections and occupational health and safety protections if they work. I actually think the second one is going to be a much stronger and more successful argument. Maybe you can say that as part of the punishment, I'm required to work, but if you say that, then you have to pay me the minimum wage. You have to make sure that there are safety protections in place. You have to do basic things like data collection and compensation for injuries on the job. These are things that are now not required in carceral facilities, even when people are working.
How do other countries handle this? Do prisoners work in other countries in prison?
Yes, people definitely work in other countries. The thing that makes the American context different is, I think, two things. One is the connection to slavery and the idea that in our federal constitution and then in, you know, 20 state constitutions, we have an explicit authorization, effectively, of enslavement for people who are convicted of crimes. You don't see that anywhere else. And there are minimal, if any, worker protections for incarcerated workers, where in other jurisdictions you would see more of that, certainly in places like Norway where people are, you know, where the systems in general are more respectful of incarcerated people.
So your position is that if we're going to force prisoners to work, they should be paid minimum wage, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So what would that look like and what would that cost, let's just say, in California?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you said in your introduction, there was a proposed change to the California Constitution that was coming through the legislature. It did not pass. And Governor Newsom, in expressing support for rejecting the change, made a point of saying that if we instituted the change, it would cost billions and billions of dollars. And I think he's not wrong. I think the price tag would be enormous. Now, part of the reason the price tag would be so enormous is America loves to incarcerate. And we have so many prisons and so many jails, and all of them require labor to keep going. So if you have, you know, if you have multiple, you know, in California, we have 33 adult facilities. If you have 33 adult facilities with thousands of people incarcerated in each facility, it's going to cost a lot of money to do the basic things that you need to keep a facility going and keep people alive, you know, like food and cleaning and laundry and other, you know, basic things like, you know, in many facilities, the electrical work, the plumbing are done by incarcerated workers. So basically, as I think I suggested, you know, we're getting prisons on the cheap. And if we want to incarcerate at the rate that we are incarcerating, I think society has to decide to pay for it, or else we should rethink the scope of our incarcerated population.
Sharon Dolovich, law professor at UCLA, where she leads their prison law and policy program. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Coming up, the New Yorker magazine writer Hua Xu is here to talk about his new memoir, Stay True. It's about the death of his best friend when the two of them were in college.
It's not really about centering, you know, my pain or, you know, our grief, but it's really about kind of honoring his memory.
That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What does it mean to be a good friend? That is the essential question in New Yorker writer Hua Xu's new memoir. He grew up in Cupertino, the son of Taiwanese immigrants, and went to UC Berkeley. He was an artsy, introverted kid who loved alternative music, wore thrifted clothes, created a zine. During his freshman year, he met a guy named Ken, who was pretty much his opposite. Ken was in a frat. He liked the Dave Matthews Band. They couldn't have been more different, except they were both Asian American. Ken was of Japanese descent. Was, because less than 3 years after they met, Ken was killed in a carjacking. Hua Xu's new memoir is called Stay True, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Madeline.
It's great to have you. Well, you write early on in the book that the first time you met Ken, you hated him. Why did you hate him?
You know, I was a pretty insufferably pretentious kid. Perhaps I retain some of those traits now, but, you know, I was very judgmental of other people. It was the 90s after all, and I think taste really mattered in ways that, you know, were pretty novel at the time. And so I just thought he was a very kind of generically mainstream person. He seemed really self-confident in ways that I found alien. But, you know, a lot of it was just a total misreading of someone who became a very dear friend.
Well, aren't all teenagers judgmental? Isn't that sort of the definition of a teenager?
Yeah, but I was like judgmental about other people's judgments. You know, I sort of really took it to, I think, another level of just wanting to be different, not only from my family and friends, but just even the people closest to me. I was just really fascinated with discovering new things and esoteric knowledge. And It's sort of what drew me to a school like Berkeley. I just thought I'm going to meet so many people who are into the exact same obscure things and obscure bands as I am. So, you know, when I got to college, the last thing I wanted was someone who was into, you know, stuff that was on MTV or whatnot.
Right. It was just mainstream, and you're like, ugh, this is boring and not why I'm in college. I want to be thrilled and challenged and excited by my friendships. So why did you become friends with him?
You know, what I didn't appreciate when I first met him was that he was just really open-minded and really kind and generous in ways that I thought I was, but I actually wasn't. I was only curious about the things, you know, I was already curious about. And he would ask me questions about the way I dressed or the music I was into. And, you know, over time, I think we came to kind of reckon with each other's pasts or each other's dreams in ways that, I don't know, just created a real bond.
Mm. So he, despite all of the trappings that you didn't appreciate, the inner core was something that attracted you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he believed in a lot of things and he dreamed of things that I was afraid to really admit that I wanted to. And so I think there was a real energy and a vitality to him that drew people to him, not just me. Mm-hmm. But it was so different from how I wanted to present myself in the world. I wanted to be sort of cool and unflappable. And that meant not really expecting too much of the world. And I think Ken was someone who kind of showed me that, you know, we should ask for more, that we should be demanding more of the culture that produces us.
So you quote Jacques Derrida, the French philosopher, about friendship. And he says, a friend would choose knowing rather than being known. Which you write flipped your idea upside down of what it meant to be a friend. Let me say it again. Choose knowing rather than being known, which is so great and simple, especially for Derrida, who's
absolutely
not really known for being easily understandable.
We've maxed out my understanding of Derrida right now. So
Mine too. I studied him at Berkeley as well. So how did that change the way you saw your relationship with Ken?
I think in the moment, I couldn't have put language to it because when you're young, you're just busy living. You know, you're busy looking toward the future. You're not really thinking about things as they're happening. And a lot of this really became clearer in his absence, just this idea of like, you know, why was it so just incredibly deep when he would ask me questions about like my zine or like the kinds of clothes I wore, like what was he trying to know about me and what was I trying to know about him? Like I wanted to be seen, I wanted to be known and understood, but I wasn't the type of person who would then sort of naturally reciprocate and ask the same questions of another person. And it was a quality that I think a lot of people, you know, whether it was like his brothers in the frat or other folks in class or just people in our friend group, like it's a quality that we always appreciated in him was his desire to know you more so than kind of wanting to insert himself into things.
Hmm. And you say that Japanese American kids can seem like aliens to other Asians, untroubled, largely oblivious to outsiders. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting facet of Asian American identity, particularly I would say on the West Coast. And I think this is one of those things where like Asian Americans are already such a kind of underrepresented group in the country. And this is something that only a specific sliver of this already obscure identity recognizes. But what I was trying to say was, you know, by virtue of having been here for more generations, like a lot of Japanese Americans settled in this country in the early 1900s or in the late 1800s, a lot of the rest of us don't really have roots in the country that are so unbroken. And so when I was in high school, when I was in college, encountering folks like Ken, they just seemed so much more at ease with being in America. You know, their families were more acculturated. Their families seemed more assimilated. People didn't speak with accents. And so from the outside, you would just look at us and say, you're just both Asians. But kind of within the community, there are these kind of slight gradations that only we notice sometimes. And it was something that I really saw in him. But it also kind of blinded me to some of the nuances of his own experience to assume that he was so comfortable.
Mm. Did he ever talk about being uncomfortable?
Yeah, and that was something that I think really made our friendship feel intimate, was just sort of, I think when you begin to understand the dreams, but also the disappointments that your friends feel day to day, you understand kind of who they are more holistically. And, you know, it was something that we would talk about every now and then, you know, just the way I think all college students talk about what they dream of, what they hope for, and what seems completely out of reach. But I think a lot of his dreams about sort of, you know, seeing Asian Americans in film and TV, or just sort of entering into the mainstream more, these are things that I would have never dreamed possible. So I didn't even express any desire for them. I was perfectly happy just kind of lobbing spitballs from the margins, but he wanted so much more.
Yeah. So in a way, it was safer for you to be the cool alterna kid who wasn't interested in joining the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of why I would, you know, make my zines and mixtapes and just sort of, you know, these were things that I was really passionate about, but it also felt like entering into a manageably small world and not sort of kind of these lofty expectations that I assume you'd always be disappointed about.
Yeah. What do you think Ken got from you? Why did he want to be your friend?
I really don't know. I think, you know, I think it was really just in his nature that he was a person who kind of wanted to understand the different perspectives of others, but also just kind of like how different dynamics of people like worked together as a community or as a friend group. And so I think he sort of understood my insecurities, but also kind of recognized something of his own, but appreciated having this perspective that was a little bit different, but since he was more open-minded than me, that could enrich him rather than be sort of a source of judgment.
How long have you been working on this? Which centers Ken, really. So maybe it's a memoir of both of you, but how long have you been working on this?
So I'm 45 right now, and I started writing it. Well, at the time, I didn't know I was writing a book or a memoir or anything. But you know, he was killed in July of 1998, and the day after we found out, I immediately began writing. And it wasn't out of some dream of becoming a writer; it was just sort of a place to go. I just wanted to escape onto the page, and you know, like, write down our memories, write down our inside jokes, things I never wanted to forget. It was a way, I think, in retrospect, of not really being present with my grief or with the sense of loss. And so some of the book dates all the way back to those first few hours after we found out. And it's something that I've been working on sort of in the back of my mind for, you know, 20 some years. It's always been a part of kind of, I think, how I see the world and the things that I want to see.
You trying to figure out this relationship or what? What exactly about that?
You know, I think there was something about writing in that immediate aftermath that became not really an addiction, but there was a sort of, I really wanted to just be able to describe things that about him, about how it felt in that moment. And so all of these years, like, I've really been chasing that feeling of kind of just being able to describe the past, being able to capture some of it in language. And I think that's behind a lot of the writing I do, is just sort of trying to translate some image or some sensation into words. There's a kind of hope, I think, in a lot of my cultural criticism that I sometimes think goes back to this moment and sort of, needing to piece together a vision of the world afterwards.
Yeah, and sort of trying to figure out what the truth really was, right? There's a moment where Ken's, after he dies, Ken's girlfriend asks you, were you really good friends with him? Were you really that close? And that really throws you for a loop.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that, you know, you begin to kind of wonder what authority you have as a writer or as a storyteller. That's how I sort of regard that question. And I think part of my process of just figuring out how to move forward was realizing that, like, I'm not like the protagonist of his story. You know, that what happened to him can never change, but what can change is sort of how his friends and I sort of move through the world with his spirit, or sort of use him as a guide. And that it's not really about centering, you know, my pain or, you know, our grief, but it's really about kind of honoring his memory and trying to imagine what he could have mm-hmm. been.
Do you think you would have become a writer if you hadn't started writing like that furiously after he died?
I don't know. I really can't say. I've always liked writing. You know, I would write, make these zines or sort of write for school papers, but I always assumed I would just be like an accountant or a lawyer or something. Like, I didn't think I would actually be a writer, but the process of writing it and the process of finishing it has really sort of clarified for me, like, what I was searching for as a writer all these years. But I always kind of had that dream of actually like writing this thing that I started writing that July.
Wow. So he really, his death really changed your life.
Yeah.
It's really astonishing that you didn't know each other that long, what, less than 3 years, and yet he just completely changed your life and set you on this course.
Yeah, and when I think about this, because I'm still quite close with, I don't know, I would say like 90% of the people in the book, and I think we all change each other's lives. It's just that, you know, we have the luxury of not having to dwell on it because we're still in each other's lives. You know, mm-hmm. and so it sort of is this reminder that we should just sort of hold tight the people in our lives, and that all friendships change us. It's just that we don't necessarily have to narrativize them or reflect on them because those stories are still ongoing for most of us.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the little moments you talk about, like the midnight runs to get donuts and being in the car and listening to music and just these kind of flashes of friendship, of mundane moments in people's lives. When someone is dead, you look back on those moments and they have so much more meaning. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think boredom is this necessary precondition for friendship. You know, you just have to be bored with other people. And I think if you are lucky enough, just have friends over the course of like years or decades, you know, like those mundane moments get layered over by new mundane moments. But when you have this finite number, then I just became really fixated and sort of almost obsessive about those moments and thinking about what they meant and what they could mean as memories.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that the book is out, like, how do you, and it's finished, and you've been thinking about this for most of your adult life. How are you seeing it now? I mean, are you kind of, I don't know, how do you feel about it being finished and out in the world?
It's very weird because I feel like I was just writing stuff down just to cope and just as a way of grieving, really. When I was in my 20s, I wasn't thinking about it as literature or as a story someone would one day read or interpret. And so I think some of the kind of quiet mundaneness or the kind of things that seemed incidental take on this like kind of symbolic weight now that it's been written as a story and we're sort of open to interpretation as characters. So it's very weird. I find myself trying to kind of think my way out of being this character, but I know it's also impossible because that's just what happens when something gets put into a story and then put into a book. It's been very gratifying, but it's also been sort of odd at a personal level.
I know. As I was reading it, I felt like you were being too hard on yourself and painting yourself as more of a a dislikable character than you really are.
I enjoyed sort of making fun of my teenage pretentiousness. Uh-huh. But the book is meant to be like a gesture of friendship towards Ken and towards my other friends. And even though it is a gesture of friendship, it's not necessarily a chronicle of me having been this great friend in the moment. And so I think just being very conscious of that, I was a little harder on myself, but I think it's all in the service of jokes usually. So
Yeah, because I could see through it. I could see that you actually were a good friend, even though you profess otherwise.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you.
Thanks. This is just a really lovely conversation. I'm very appreciative.
Oh, thank you. That's Hua Xu. His new memoir is called Stay True. And if you want to hear more from him, he'll be giving a talk at Skylight Books here in Los Angeles on Thursday, November 10th. Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here to tell us how to make fall salads that go beyond kale. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentils?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Salad. It is not just for summer. There are lots of ways to use fall produce in salads. That goes beyond simple kale. And here with some ideas is Evan Kleiman. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so often I'll just have a bag of kale or a bag of mixed greens or a bag of arugula, toss it onto a plate, throw some vinaigrette on it, and call it a day. But you're here to tell me I don't have to be so boring, right?
Yeah, when it comes to fall, I kind of forget about the lettuce, or the lettuce takes a way background role. There's so many crunchy vegetables that I think work as a perfect foil to foods that we eat a lot in the fall that are softer. You know, all the squashes, more stews, things that have a richness that we don't necessarily eat during the summer.
So you want to pair that with a heartier salad, a crunchier salad?
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily heartier, but I would say something that has a lot of texture and a nice forward kind of vinaigrette that has some acid to it. So it kind of cleanses your palate and gives you a break from all that other richness.
The unctuousness.
Exactly.
All right. So first up, we have a radish salad, the opposite of unctuous. Tell us what's in that.
It's an absolutely gorgeous salad because you use mixed radishes, so all the different colors and types. So there are the kind like that are called Easter egg radishes that are all pretty much the same shape and size, but might be different colors. Maybe they're red on the outside, purple on the outside, white. And then there's also watermelon radishes, which are bigger and have that just glorious color running through them, whether or not they're red focused or green focused. And so this particular salad is just all of those radishes trimmed up and sliced and then mixed with just a simple lemon, olive oil, and salt vinaigrette with some herbs.
Yum. Sometimes people are put off by how spicy radishes can be. Is there a way to mellow the spice?
Yeah, add cheese.
A solution for everything, I think.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these salads that tend to have a lot of crunch are often paired with cheese. So I think if you're eating them as a main course, the cheese is really great. But maybe if you're having it as a side dish that kind of acts almost as a slaw, that maybe you want to go without the cheese because the richness of whatever else you're eating will cut the spice.
Okay, moving on to a salad that was popular way back in the 19th century. You have a recipe for Waldorf salad. And what is in it?
I love a Waldorf salad. Originally, it was just apple slices and celery mixed with mayonnaise on bib lettuce. But you know, over the years, people added things to it. And I think now when people think of a Waldorf salad, they also think of the additions of walnuts and sometimes grapes. And I just think it's just apples are everywhere this mm-hmm. time of year. And now we have all these different varieties of apples that are so crisp and yeah. beautiful that it's just a great salad to remember to make.
How do you make it less mayonnaise-y?
You can get rid of the mayonnaise completely, and instead of having a creamy dressing, you can make like a mustard vinaigrette. Mm-hmm. But if you want it to be creamy, you could use yogurt instead or creme fraiche. There are many different ways of making that dressing, so it doesn't have to be so mayonnaise forward, which isn't really my thing either.
All right, one more. Let's talk about one of your favorites. It is a winter salad with fennel. How do you make that one?
Well, I really love fennel, and I know that a lot of people can't get behind the light licorice flavor of it, but I really, really love fennel. And I also like the light color of a winter salad. Often fennel is paired with Belgian endive, but in this case, it's paired with celery root, which is so delicious. I mean, I'm a big celery fan too. And celery root has this really great kind of meaty crunch. And you cut it up into really thin batons. And again, this is just a really simple dressing. Toss with lemon and olive oil. It has a little bit of chopped parsley. But it also has the addition of pumpkin seeds, which is perfect for the season and adds another texture to the mix. And then, of course, there is some sliced pecorino cheese.
And finally, how would you dress up a kale salad? How would you make it less kale-y?
Well, I tend to sort of embrace whatever I'm eating. And I, you know, being such an italophile, I'm a fan for slightly bitter greens, mm-hmm. which kale is. I think that the technique of first massaging it with a little bit of salt is great because it breaks it down a little bit. But I really love an anchovy garlic vinaigrette where you just take a like an anchovy and garlic and you mush them up together and then you add olive oil and vinegar. I personally love red wine vinegar, but you could use sherry vinegar. And maybe you'll add a little bit of mustard, salt, and pepper. And I just think that kale is so assertive. It's well served with an assertive dressing.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. And that's something that actually can keep. But other salad, it's hard to keep after the night that you eat it if you have leftovers. Do you have any recommendations?
I always eat salad for breakfast.
You do?
I eat wilted salad for breakfast all the time. I don't know. I love the way that the acid in the dressing cooks. It cooks the lettuce. And what is lettuce? It's just a green. Yeah. We've just in our heads divided them up and said, okay, these greens are for cooking. These other mm-hmm. greens are for eating raw. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. I guess you could actually cook lettuce too, like saute it. Or grill it.
Yeah, you can. And it's delicious. Romaine is delicious. Often I'll throw it into soups if I'm, you know, if I'm lazy and I don't want to go out and buy kale or spinach or chard. Once you've dressed the whole salad, there's really no way of quote, keeping it from wilting like that. And I really don't find individually dressed salads very appealing. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you.
No, I don't.
You want to throw it on, toss it all.
Yeah. It's all part of it. It's a dish. It's a whole meal. It's like taking out an ingredient when you're cooking something. Why would you do that? All right. All the recipes will be at KCRW.com. Evan Kleinman is host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturday mornings at 10 on the radio or whenever you want, wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, Well, that does it for us today on Press Play. Tomorrow, actor Tim Robbins will be here. He'll talk about 40 years of his Actors Gang Theater. They've expanded to teach children now, and they go into prisons. We'll hear all about it tomorrow with Tim Robbins. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We're at KCW Press Play. I usually put my little whiteboard up there on my personal account, which is at The Mad Brand, so you can check that out, too, on Instagram. And that's it. I'll see you tomorrow.